From KALW in San Francisco, this is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our media roundtable, the day you join journalists in a critical conversation about the week's news. The Trump administration's war on the media reached new levels this week. Steve Bannon, the white nationalist who is now chief White House strategist, told the New York Times that the media should keep its mouth shut. He repeatedly described the media as the opposition party. The ongoing media war is getting nonstop attention, and it obviously deserves attention. But it's also distracting from real issues. This week, Donald Trump issued draft and executive orders to repeal Obamacare, drastically cut family planning funding overseas, which puts women's lives at risk. In fact, many will die, according to reports. Institute a hiring freeze on federal workers except for the military, build a wall along the southern border with Mexico, deport undocumented immigrants, withhold funding to sanctuary cities, withdraw from the TPP, construct the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines, and so much more. According to Politico, the executive orders have been written by Stephen Miller, Trump's senior White House advisor for policy, and Steve Bannon, Trump's chief strategist. So how are the media covering all of this? Well, joining us today are three reporters. Jack Cushman is editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, an independent nonprofit news organization that covers environmental issues. Jack is author of the book Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're glad to have you. Thanks for joining us. Yoan Grillo is a journalist and writer based in Mexico City. He has covered Latin America since 2001 for Reuters, the Houston Chronicle, and the AP. His latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Hi, Yoan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Great to have you back. And Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a human rights lawyer, and the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Wow. Well, it's great to have all of you. What a week it has been. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So, Scott Horton, let's start off with you. What really caught your attention this week?
Well, a story yesterday by Andrew Kramer, who is in the Moscow office of the New York Times, about top Russian cybercrimes agents being arrested on charges of treason. And I think this is the sort of story that's very, very difficult for a foreign reporter to do in Russia, which he's done, and he scooped. And it may wind up being something far more consequential. So it is the first arrest. We now have reports of an additional three, so it looks like four key assets of U.S. intelligence in Russia are being tracked down and arrested. And this process starts 48 hours after the transition to Trump. So it's suggesting to a lot of people in the U.S. intelligence community that somewhere in the highest echelons of this government is a person who's working for the Russian intelligence services.
And how do we? Where's this information coming from?
Well, I think he started by tracking down the individual who was involved, and he got specific information concerning the arrest. That was then corroborated by the Moscow Times, English language press in Moscow. And we now have reports in the Russian media also corroborating it.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that. That is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's. And what about you, Jack? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I was entranced by a book review by Bill McKibben in the New York Review of Books. It had nothing to do with climate change. It was about the revenge of analog, real things and why they matter, a book by David Sachs. And it's all about what McKibben describes and Sachs describes as a return to board games like Monopoly that are on boards, books that are actually on bookshelves, and records that are on LPs, getting back to the real world in a week in which I've been inundated by the pings, dings, and notifications of various mobile and desktop devices at this kind of extraordinary time of crisis. As McKibben says about books, you can't show off how smart you are by leaving your iPad on the table, and I've encouraged myself to get back to reading real books like The Age of Jackson by Arthur Schlesinger, which is about another extraordinary time in our capital. and playing board games with a new neighbor, sitting there with the dominoes clicking. It's a form of relaxation when we're all, I have to say, a little tense.
Well, I laugh because what a week it is to grab a book and go to the park. And I was just checking out the arts section in the New York Times, and George Orwell's 1984 shot to number one on Amazon's bestseller list this week when Kellyanne Conway was talking about alternative facts on Meet the Press. So people are going back to George Orwell. You might want to take 1984 and go outside. Well, thank you for that one, Jack. And what about you, Johan Grillo? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, one interesting thing is that there's a very great Mexican journalist called Carmen Aristegui, who had an extremely popular radio show for several years that was taken off the air, supposedly under pressure from the Mexican government, because she was making these incredible investigations unveiling corruption in Mexico. And just last week, actually, it just came back on. They couldn't find a radio to actually put it back on, but it came on online as a radio show online. So it's quite interesting to see how that plays out, and kind of, you know, beating this pressure from government's pressure from the radio owners with money censoring news. See, within the internet era, if that can be broken in Mexico. So definitely keeping an eye out on that show and how that does.
All right, and sorry about the line. Johan, we're having I can't hear you very well. Maybe if you can move to a different spot where you are, that might help. That is Johan Grillo. He's a journalist and writer based in Mexico City, and we will put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive in and talk about what a week this has been. A few hours after Donald Trump was sworn in, he signed an executive order to begin the process to repeal Obamacare. And since then, we have woken up to new executive orders almost every single day. I mentioned them in the intro. It's really difficult to keep up with all of this. Journalists are constantly covering his tweets, which we're now learning happen in response to what he watches on television, on sometimes Meet the Press and on Fox News. And then Sean Spicer had his first press conference last week. He focused on the size of the inauguration that got wall-to-wall coverage. Kellyanne Conway said Spicer provided, quote, alternative facts. So, Scott Horton, there's so much going on. We cannot ignore when someone like Steve Bannon says that the media is the opposition party and should shut its mouth, but we also don't want to get distracted. So what are your thoughts on how the media should deal with this?
Well, I think one of the games that's being played by people like Bannon and Spicer is to control the media and the media coverage and direct it to the specific stories that they want. And I think the series of executive orders play an important role in that. And also the fights that are being picked play a role in that. So by whipping up storms around certain things, they're able to monopolize media coverage to ensure that most of it is focused on those issues. So we saw immediately after the inauguration, we saw a huge tempest whipped up over the question of how large the crowds were at inauguration compared to the day after. Not something of significance or consequence for the country going forward, but something that was pursued aggressively by Trump and by others. And then thereafter, we've seen this parade of executive orders. And these executive orders are not like executive orders that have been issued in prior presidencies. So the pattern historically has been that an executive order comes out of or in coordination with the agency to which it relates, and it's done as an act of administrative law that actually has legal effect. These executive orders, as you noted in the lead-in, are not done in consultation with the Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Human Services, et cetera, et cetera. They're crafted by a handful of non-expert persons in the White House, and they're crafted mostly, very clearly, I think, for purposes of propaganda. So it is designed to make a statement and to put out the president's views on an issue and to set a tone for that issue, not really so much to change law. That creates a dilemma, I think, for the media.
Well, and Politico, again, is reporting that, as you said, Donald Trump is not working with even high-level Republicans on these orders or agencies. He's working with Stephen Miller, his senior White House advisor for policy, and Steve Bannon, his chief strategist. And let's not forget that Bannon ran Breitbart News, the far-right conservative site that provided a platform for white nationalists. So he's working on these orders with Steve Bannon. And according to Politico, sources talk to Politico. We'll talk about this later, but so many executives in the White House are leaking so much information to the media in just the first week of the presidency. But they're saying that Trump and Bannon are writing these executive orders.
And these two gentlemen have something in common. That is, they're both very close to neo-Nazi groups. And in fact, Haaretz in Israel has done a look into their background and has found the links. So they're fringe right, hardly in the center of the Republican Party. Indeed, not even with substantial connections within the party, although Miller was a former senior staffer for Jeff Sessions.
Jack, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I've been watching the news, listening nonstop. I'm not really hearing much about Bannon's past with Breitbart News not very long ago, the far-right conservative site that provided a platform for white nationalists. How important is it for the media to remind viewers and listeners of these connections?
Well, I think that there are many connections in my field of interest, environment and climate. The most pronounced observation that we've seen is the thorough seeding of the cabinet, really from President Trump and the vice president on down, but with a range of climate denial proponents who have great ties, deep ties to the fossil fuel industries, and who are essentially pursuing a fossil fuel-oriented economic strategy. This is very significant, even though we won't know the particulars until the White House and its team figure them out for themselves. It's quite clear that from the EPA to the Interior Department and other agencies like Agriculture and Justice, at the State Department, where the Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson will attempt to build a team, which is now consists of nobody, and deal with the climate crisis as a diplomat, as a regulator, as the owner of the public resource, as the enforcer of environmental statutes. Cabinet members are clearly showing that they are devoted to the fossil fuel agenda, and this is really unmistakable. Now, where it's showing up is in the noise and on the Twitter feeds and in the casually written executive orders and memoranda, many of which it's hard to make sense of yet. If you happen to go to a park, as we were discussing, it's a national park, and you see a park ranger, you might thank them for being among the most forthright explainers to the public of the real risks of climate change that we face. And when the Park Service found its Twitter feeds interrupted, it was extraordinary to see places like Badlands National Park tweeting out climate facts until they would be removed from the web, and other national parks sending out Redwoods National Park, just noting in a quick tweet that redwoods are a major way of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing them safely. These are subtweets or subliminal messages in the Twitter feed reminding Trump that he will be in charge of science-based agencies, NOAA, NASA, EPA, the Park Service, the Geologic Service, a whole apparatus of climate research, and that the scientists are really unlikely to roll over and start expounding fake science with a change of administration.
And we'll talk about that later. There are now more than 40 of what's being called rogue U.S. government Twitter accounts dedicated to sharing facts. Rogue NSA, for example, Alt NASA. I mean, this is just exploding in the last couple of days. And, Yoan, before we dive in and talk about Mexico specifically, you have been in Mexico City as a journalist for 15 years. As someone just south of the border, what are your thoughts on how you think journalists should juggle this ongoing media war with the Trump administration, an administration that is lying about so many things, while at the same time not getting distracted, by ignoring very real issues that really affect the lives of people around the world?
Well, I think covering governments in Latin America actually gives quite a lot of experience about dealing with this kind of president. And people who would attack the media and censor the media. Now, if you look at the quote from Bannon, it looks like he was very deliberately said this. He said, you know, the media should shut up, and he said, yes, I want you to quote that. So I think it actually prepared this thing knowing that would create a big media splash. And the reason that they like very much to confront the media is it fits into this populist idea of the people, or their idea of the people, against some idea of an elite, being the media elite. Now they're in power, it's harder to campaign against the Washington elite itself, because they are the elite, but they move it to attack the media. And I think this is a conflict they're going to focus on in a big way throughout the administration. I think we have to be thick-skinned about it and not be too caught up in this fight. But we also have to defend press freedom, and I think there might well be actual serious attacks on censorship during this administration, but we have to keep on focusing on the issues and focusing on holding them up, holding them to account on what they are doing.
Well, and let's talk about what's happening with Mexico. This is getting so much attention. In fact, CNN just sent out a breaking news alert that Donald Trump and Mexican President Peña Nieto spoke on the phone, and the White House is expected to provide details in a conference. But before we talk about that, let's just talk about what happened here. Yesterday, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto canceled next Thursday's meeting with Trump after Trump tweeted, quote, "If Mexico is unwilling to pay for the badly needed wall, then it would be better to cancel the upcoming meeting," end quote. Peña Nieto then tweeted, "This morning, we have informed the White House that I will not attend the meeting." Now, Trump continues to say that Mexico will pay for this wall, estimated to cost $12 to $15 billion. And then White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said Trump wants a 20% tax on Mexican imports to pay for this, and then he backtracked. How is this story unfolding in Mexico? You just wrote a piece for Time magazine about how Mexicans are planning to boycott U.S. companies there.
Well, I mean, people in Mexico are freaking out. I think it would be the word. People are scared. People are angry. People are looking to defiance. It's quite amazing. I've been here 15 years. I've never seen anything like this. How over days the U.S.-Mexico relationship is unfolding. And unthinkable things that would be unthinkable a few months ago, are being contemplated. NAFTA has been a cornerstone of Mexico's economic policy for 25 years. Now people are saying, I mean, top business leaders and the government are saying, if we have to leave NAFTA, we'll leave NAFTA. I was actually talking to a political scientist yesterday who I've talked to over the 15 years and actually said, do you fear at this point armed intervention from the United States? I actually asked that question. It was actually amazing to even ask that question in modern times. And the president, we really fear this. We think it's a real fear now. This is the impression people have and a feeling with this. So in terms of actually what Trump's been doing in this process, he pushed President Peña Nieto into a corner where he had no choice but to cancel. President Peña Nieto tried to have a very soft approach, tried to negotiate from the beginning, tried to not get pulled into a fight, and that failed. And he was forced to cancel, and it looks like they're going to go down a road that's going to simply be of conflict. It seems very hard to resolve these issues with President Trump.
That is Yoan Griot, journalist and writer based in Mexico City and author of Gangster Warlords. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's, author of Lords of Secrecy, and Jack Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News and author of Keystone and Beyond. And if you'd like to join us, Yoan will stay with us for about 5 more minutes. If you have any questions or comments on what is happening with the U.S.-Mexico relationship and what just has been going down in the last couple of days, what strikes you about the reporting? What strikes me is most of the reporting is focusing on how this will affect Americans, but not how it will affect Mexicans. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Yoan, what about that? I've been watching some of the cable shows, and a lot of it is about how the prices will go up and this will really affect citizens in the United States. But how are Mexicans reacting to how their country is being treated by this new administration?
Well, people are very scared. If there were to be some of these measures were to be carried out, such as a 20% tax on Mexican goods flowing to the United States, we're talking about a third of Mexico's economy is based on exports to the United States. If there was massive deportations of 3 million Mexicans, and we're talking about Mexico receiving about $25 billion every year from people who work in the United States and send money home. If there really was this effort to extort this $15 billion, the Mexican economy could really go into a very serious recession. Now, also from the Americans' point of view, this is important, because if Mexico was to go into that kind of meltdown, if it was to be destabilized, this affects the United States as well. You don't want a neighbor which is completely destabilized. It's already in a difficult situation. We've already seen years of hardcore cartel-related violence. We've already seen earlier this year looting because of a rise in gasoline prices. Now, if we were to really be pushed over the edge, that would be bad for Mexico, but that would also be bad for the United States.
And Scott Horton, what are your thoughts on this? How dangerous is Donald Trump's rhetoric and the way he talks about Mexico and Mexicans? I mean, when he talks about NAFTA, it's always about Mexico. He never brings up Canada.
I think that's right. So people are mostly focused on this issue of the wall, and that's been used to provoke the conflict that's going on right now. And I think it's clear that this is just it's bullying, and it's just a cover issue. What lies behind it is a very radical attitude towards the structure of the world and global trade, and a desire to collapse the main pillars of the global economy, and that includes NAFTA. So I think Trump's, and I think we see this in several statements that have come out of the White House in the last couple of days, his major objective here is to terminate NAFTA. Now, NAFTA is a treaty that was ratified by Congress, so he can't unilaterally end it. He's trying to provoke the Mexicans to build the basis for a struggle that will allow him to unravel it. And unraveling NAFTA doesn't just mean a problem for trade relations with Mexico. It also means problems for trade relations with Canada as well. And I think we see the same thing with the TPP, with the threats made against the Germans and the threats of tariffs being imposed on BMWs being imported. It is a radical wipeout of the existing free trade arrangements and an attack on all of the infrastructure for those arrangements. It is sweeping and dramatic, and it would produce chaos in the global economy, no doubt about that.
And let's not forget that Trump kicked off his campaign in June 2015 with a speech in which he labeled immigrants from Mexico rapists and criminals. Yoan, same question to you. What are the real ramifications of this ongoing rhetoric? I mean, the peso has fallen sharply. The country has really suffered from NAFTA, the so-called drug war, corruption, immigrants in the U.S. send $25 billion back to Mexico every year. So what are the real ramifications here?
Well, you know, you have a 2,000-mile border. You know, it's one of the biggest land borders in the world. So you have all of these things going back and forth are a shared responsibility. Now, if Donald Trump really wants to push this through and set back those relations 100 years. Because, you know, if you go back to the times of the Mexican Revolution, where there was more of a hostile, you know, back and forth there, and the United States was involved in a coup in Mexico against one of the presidents then, you're really talking about going back to that time. And now with the size of populations we have in these two countries, with the goods going back and forth, that's a very dangerous thing. So Mexico can say some kind of leverage. I mean, Mexico's going to suffer more from this, because Mexico does depend more on the United States and the $10 trillion of the United States. They can say things like, we're not going to stop anymore the flow of Central Americans who are moving through our country going to the United States. We're not going to stop that anymore. So paradoxically, you could end up getting more immigrants coming rather than less. They could say, we're not going to stop the flow of drugs and go after high-level targets that you name anymore. We're not going to stop when there's very, very heavy criminal armed groups operating on the border. So you could have a much more dangerous environment for the United States if this relationship completely unravels, which it looks like it could do.
Well, Johan, we'd love to have you back. I think we need to have a conversation about NAFTA and the facts around NAFTA. So thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be here.
Johan Grillo is a journalist and writer based in Mexico City. He's been reporting from there for 15 years. He's been reporting for Reuters, the AP, the Houston Chronicle, and other publications. Check out his latest book. It's now out in paperback. It's called Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. We had Johan on last year, to talk about that book. And coming up after the break, we'll continue with Jack Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, and Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. A show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with a former CIA operative who questioned Saddam Hussein after he was taken into custody by the U.S. military. We'll be speaking with John Nixon about his new book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. That's on Monday, and if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we're joined today by Jack Cushman, editor and reporter for Inside Climate News, an independent nonprofit news organization that covers environmental issues. Jack is the author of Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a human rights lawyer, and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And if you'd like to join us, it's just week one of the Trump administration, and so much is happening. It's incredibly difficult to keep up with all of this. And one of the really important questions is, how do you cover this ongoing war on the media without being distracted from the real issues? So what do you think? How are the media doing? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show. Hi, Alicia. Are you with us? Do we have Alicia? No. Okay. Well, let's move on to a story that's getting a lot of attention this week. The Huffington Post reports that a source inside the EPA told a congressional staffer to freeze grants and contracts. They were also told not to discuss this order with anyone outside of the agency. The EPA staffer gave the information to a congressional office anonymously, fearing retaliation. Jack, what do we know about this? And what about this? These kinds of directives to other agencies like the Interior Department and NOAA? Do we have Jack? Is Jack there? Okay, we lost Jack. We're having some phone or... Is Scott, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. Scott, have you been following this issue with these directives that are going to various environmental organization agencies?
Absolutely. I mean, they have one of the things that's been going on has been a sweeping stop to expenditures, and that has particularly targeted the agencies that have a science relationship. So EPA is one of the big ones, and what appears to be behind it is concern that there's ongoing money that supports science research that's not politically acceptable to this administration, which might be things relating to global warming or climate change or things of that sort, but also many other subjects. And that's led to this measure, which is very, very harsh. I mean, if you go in and you look at where you know how this grant money is spent, I mean, an awful lot of it, for instance, in villages in Alaska, this is how money is dispensed to allow people to purify and clean their water. Mm. That's probably the biggest single category of funding that has now been frozen within the EPA. So they're doing this, but they also want to do all this furtively, secretively. They don't want anyone to know that they're doing it, so they're trying to draw a curtain around it all, and that's a curtain that's designed to ensure that not only the public doesn't know about it, but also the Congress doesn't know about it, and that's just wrong. That's secret government.
I mean, it's incredible. ProPublica is asking government employees to leak information without fear of retribution, and then because all of this is happening, we're seeing these what's being called as these rogue U.S. government Twitter accounts, AltNatParkSer for the National Park Service, Rogue NSA, Actual EPA Facts, Alt NSA. I mean, these rogue Twitter accounts are getting more followers than the official Twitter accounts.
That's absolutely right. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this works out and, you know, how they're able to implement this gag. I mean, there have been, of course, efforts to gag the civil service before and to restrict what they can say. That has particularly affected the intelligence services in the military, where I think there's some reason or some justification for it. What's really striking with the Trump administration is that this is much broader. It's included the Park Service. It's included the Department of Agriculture. It's included the Environmental Protection Agency and NASA. It seems to be aimed at almost the entire government.
Jack, are you back with us? I'm sorry,
yes,
John.
I am.
John.
Sorry to have been interrupted. That's all right. And I have off and on covered the environmental and other government agencies for many, many years. And I've seen some degree of this before. But it's really not true to say, as the Trump crowd would have you believe, that every incoming administration acts this way. When the Obama administration entered office, they did so with transparency doctrines. The comparison for the EPA was to a fishbowl. There were assurances that all the memoranda having to do with the transition itself would be made public. And over the years, even though this agency, like all agencies, has fallen short of what journalists expect in transparency, so that the Society of Environmental Journalists has called the Obama EPA too secretive by far. Still in all, there are policies in place of three kinds. One is there are constitutional protections for the free speech of government employees. As long as they are not speaking in an official capacity, they are free to write letters to the editor, they're free to speak up, and they enjoy the same rights and protections that we all do. Secondly, there are scientific integrity policies in place at federal agencies, including the EPA and the Energy Department and others.
these had recently been firmed up, and they make clear that it is not permissible to shade the science for political reasons. Thirdly, there are whistleblower protections, and there are assurances for federal employees who see something that they feel is wrong, including violations of free speech and scientific integrity, but also fraud and abuse in government programs. These employees are free to contact their members of Congress, and that I assure you, they will do that. They will write letters to the editor. Scientists in Washington will be joining in a scientists' march, and the fact that they are government employees or contractors will not stop them from doing that. So Trump, I believe, in the long game, is playing a very, very dangerous game here. But it's more than a game, because the underlying effort is to cut the staff of the EPA, to discourage people from joining government service, to undermine the credibility of science. Those are the really dangerous elements of this.
Can you elaborate on that? How do you think the media are drawing connections between what we've learned this week and Trump's pick to head the EPA, Scott Pruitt, who has the former Oklahoma or the Oklahoma governor who has sued the EPA on many occasions?
Right, and of course, you know, state governments are free to sue the EPA. They would generally prefer to win their lawsuits. The AGs of Oklahoma and Texas have generally been defeated in their lawsuits. They act as though, for example, the Clean Power Plan is, on the face of it, illegal. But as far as court decisions to have come out so far, the Supreme Court has made it very clear that the law is that the EPA is to control carbon dioxide as a regulated pollutant because the agency has determined that it endangers public health and ecosystems. And there's no question that the standing law of the country is that the EPA is required to control carbon dioxide emissions. And the fact that an AG from a big oil state whose campaign was financed by oil company interests and whose petitions to the administration and the courts were written by the oil companies, and who tried even to maintain an oil-funded super PAC that would continue to contribute to his political career while he took on this new regulatory office, something that even he had to back away from. There's no question that he's out on thin ice. And I think that it's a dangerous game. It's also dangerous because the climate crisis is real. We've just experienced the third year in a row of record temperatures. Mm-hmm. The melting of the Arctic and the warming of the Arctic is extraordinary. And the understanding of what's causing this and where the solutions lie is increasingly solid. And so to have an administration that's committed to backing away from any attempt to address this, not just the Obama administration's specific attempts, but any attempt to address this, is putting people at risk, and I don't think that's a good strategy for politicians to pursue, to take money from polluting industries and pursue policies that put people at risk. Over the long term, this has proven not to be a successful strategy.
Scott, how do you think the media are covering the legal issues around this? I mean, it's very hard to keep up with all of this. People are getting bits and pieces about, you know, these government agency workers being silenced, and then, you know, renegade park rangers starting their own Twitter accounts. But in terms of what the Trump administration can do legally, how do you think that's being covered?
I think we are seeing very little coverage of the legal issues at this point. But I think a number of them have been flagged. So I think we will expect to see a lot more coverage emerge in the next few weeks of these things. And I think we're going to see court tests as well. So the First Amendment obviously offers protections for people who work inside the government, just as it offers protections to other citizens. And I think many of the things that are being ordained in these new executive orders by Trump are not things that can properly be introduced or directed by an executive order. So we're going to see challenges, and we're going to see a lot more discussion of the legality going forward, but we've seen very little of it this week.
And also, we 2 weeks ago, we did a week-long series on President Obama's legacy and what he is leaving for Donald Trump. And the New York Times' Andrew Revkin wrote that the EPA is an agency where information has been tightly controlled for many years, including under the Obama administration, which was harshly criticized by the Society of Environmental Journalists in 2013 for having taken secrecy to a new level. So, John, can you tell us how is this different from, I mean, I guess we have to see more, but based on what you've seen so far, how is this different from what we've seen under the Obama administration?
Right. Well, I have not, I am deeply sympathetic to my fellow journalists who always would like to have more access and more transparency. And I experienced this myself in coverage, for example, of the Keystone Pipeline, where the State Department attempted to not release the public comments that it was receiving on the Keystone Pipeline. And so after Inside Climate News filed FOIA petitions and pointed out to them that they were required to release public comments to the public, they turned around and began to do so. But one important difference here is that this clampdown is occurring in an atmosphere where demonstrable falsehood is the order of the day coming from the government. And so it's particularly upsetting to see an attempt to suppress the truth at a time when there's an attempt to amplify the false.
And that is, Jack, I have to ask you, do you go by Jack or John? Because your website says both.
Right. My byline is John. Everybody calls me Jack. And so I'd encourage you to call me Jack.
Okay.
And if you want to find me online, you can look up John.
All right. I just got very confused, and I wanted to make sure I called you the right name, and you go by both. Okay, that's good to know. Jack Cushman is editor and reporter for Inside Climate News and author of Keystone and Beyond. And Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Roberta in San Francisco. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. This is great. I just was wondering how the Freedom of Information Act impacts all of our information, you know, all of us in America who are so concerned about all of these extremes that are going on. And how can we get this information? I mean, I rely on a variety of news sources, as you know, as you're one of them, your show is one, and I'm like, how am I supposed to find this information out, and what can I do as a citizen to make this silly stuff stop?
Well, it's a great question, and we're getting a lot of emails along those lines, Scott. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, you know, the Freedom of Information Act has been strengthened, in fact, under the Obama administration as a statute, but the position that the administration has taken has been entrenched. So even under Obama, we saw a more aggressive posture rejecting requests for FOIA requests, even though Barack Obama himself, as a young lawyer, was involved in making FOIA requests and trying to protect whistleblowers. So I expect to see the government close up much more tightly under Trump. It's clear from things he said already that there's going to be very, very little FOIA compliance. And that's going to lead leakers, frankly, as the most important source of information to the public and to the media about what's going on inside the government.
Well, speaking of what's going on inside the government, Scott, it's been incredible to read articles in the Washington Post, Politico, the New York Times. According to these pieces, so many White House staffers are already leaking information about Donald Trump's emotional state, about how he will not take advice from staffers. He goes it alone. He tweets when he watches Fox News. I mean, this is pretty unprecedented in week one, right?
It absolutely is, but it's not too surprising, because people who have followed and dealt with Donald Trump closely One of the things that's been consistently been the case is the entourage around him includes a large number of people who hold him in complete and utter contempt and are happy to leak things about him. That was going on during the campaign. Now they moved into the White House. It's going on even more aggressively. It's like that Victorian saying that familiarity breeds contempt.
And John, at Inside Climate News, are you already receiving leaks? What do you think this is going to look like in the coming year?
Well, I wouldn't want to characterize how we do our day-to-day work. We have established quite a reputation for exposing activities such as in the Exxon new investigation, and we're deeply familiar with the way the government works, and we're hard at work maintaining transparency to the best that our tiny little operation can. Let me say this, though. The government, if it operates in isolation, becomes a hermit. And hermits don't usually, I mean, aside from a few, like St. Francis of Assisi, who we don't have in the White House, but hermits don't usually exercise broad effect. They live in isolation. Our government exercises its power through the people, and the people include academics, scientists, voters, corporations, industry associations, lawyers and lobbyists, you know, everybody from the chief cook to the bottle washer has a role in the government. And when you cut off open, efficient, transparent communications with your constituencies like that, then you become hidebound and crippled. And that's something that the government can't afford to do. So, by virtue of its very openness, it needs openness in order to survive. And all of those people with whom it engages on a day-to-day basis are potential news sources. So, journalists generally are able to cover the government from the outside in. And indeed, it's much more interesting and effective to do it that way than from the inside out. When the Centers for Disease Control decided to cancel a meeting to discuss the health effects of climate change, which has profound public health effects, The people who were planning to go to the meeting said, well, we'll have it someplace else. And Al Gore and the American Public Health Association and the Carter Center quickly said, let's have this meeting at the Carter Center, and we can get the job done, and we can get the information out. I guarantee you that meeting will have 10 times the public impact that it would have had if the CDC were running it and nobody had ever noticed that it was even going on. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that going on. When California hears that the administration is going to clamp down on Earth-oriented space science or refuse to allow the state to have strict automobile emission standards, this becomes the dominant topic of Governor Brown's State of the State address. And Governor Brown is saying, if we have to, we'll launch the satellites, and if we have to, we will regulate. But California, which is one of the largest economies in the world, is not going to abandon the climate agenda simply because Donald Trump isn't, quote, a big believer in climate science. Science doesn't depend on one person's belief in it. Science is not a belief system. It's an evidence system, and evidence is still being gathered, still being shared, and eventually will overcome even the power of fossil fuel money in Congress that's friendly to this industry.
Scott Horton, what would you add?
No, I agree with all of that. I mean, I think we're going to see a major pushback on many of these initiatives coming from the states, and I think Governor Brown has already indicated that for the case of California, and we're already seeing Governor Cuomo in New York running advertisements on television here locally, making the same sort of case that New York is not going back 300 years because Donald Trump has decided to do so.
I wanted to also talk quickly about the nominees and coverage of that. We're almost out of time, but we have a couple callers about the effectiveness of senators postponing nominations. We did a show yesterday with Antonia Yuhas about Rex Tillerson, the former Exxon CEO, whose vote in the full Senate is happening on Monday to be Secretary of State. And then you've got Jeff Sessions and Betsy DeVos on Tuesday. And what are your thoughts on how these nominees have been covered? And then also, Scott Horton, there have been protests across the country in front of congressional offices, people urging Democrats and Republicans to vote no on these nominees.
Well, there have been, but I would say the questioning so far doesn't strike me as particularly impressive as it goes to backgrounds of the nominees. It's tended to focus on policy issues going forward. And one thing I think we see clearly in the executive orders that have come out is that these nominees will say what they need to say to get confirmation and are not going to feel bound by it after they get into office.
And what are your thoughts, Jack? What do you think about media coverage of the nominations and then this pressure on the streets for Republicans and Democrats to vote against these nominations?
Well, as far as media coverage, I can assure you that the press is burning the midnight oil and doing, you know, the best in its, you know, not perfect capacities to bring these things to light. It is a very time-consuming and exhausting process, especially when there are so many egregious examples, you know, awaiting our coverage. But it takes time to read the hundreds of pages of written answers to questions. I, too, am not impressed by the acuity or by the depth of the questioning of these nominees. But there is questioning going on, and there are a determined minority in Congress trying to shed light on the subject. They don't have the votes, and so these nominees are going to be approved. But nominees can also be constrained by the continuing limelight. And the main thing for the press is not to be discouraged by the overwhelming nature of what's going on. Russell Baker of the New York Times wrote of the sensation as a young man that he was spending his life sitting around on marble floors waiting for somebody to come out and lie to him. And it can be depressing to live in that world, which we policy correspondents live in. But there's also a world out there of hope and determination. And as journalists, you just have to believe that if you keep asking the right questions and providing solid answers that are based in reality, that ultimately you'll prevail. And it may be a false hope, but it's the only one that journalists have.
Scott, your thoughts, final thoughts?
Well, I think he speaks for all of us on that score. I think the administration and its tactics present new challenges to journalism, but in a sense they're old challenges, because if we look at what went on in Europe between the wars, this is what went on. And I think we see some good recommendations for how to deal with it, which involves expose work and not being distracted by political sloganeering.
Yep, well, we're going to do our best not to get distracted. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Jack Cushman is editor and reporter for Inside Climate News and author of Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. Scott and Jack, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.